Empire Lines uncovers the unexpected, often two-way, flows of empires through art. Interdisciplinary thinkers use individual artworks as artifacts of imperial exchange, revealing the how and why of the monolith empire.
In this episode, Deborah Lee Talbot exposes the political agency of Indigenous women in British New Guinea. Through a photograph of the Papuan Giyua taken in the 1880s.
A sepia-toned photograph shows us the shoulders and the age-wrinkled face of a Papuan woman. She sits in profile, so her left cheek is turned towards the camera, and we can only see half of her face. But her shoulders, they were twisted ever so slightly to the left, and this position shows us her European-inspired Mother Hubbard dress, and also a necklace made of local shells that has been looped around her neck 6 times and then positioned ever so carefully over the dress. Underneath the image is inked cursive writing that identifies the woman as Granny. The number 276 exists in the lower right corner of the card on which the photograph is pasted. This is a photograph of Giyua, an Indigenous Motuan intermediary from the village of Hanuabada in Papua, an island in the southwestern Pacific. The photo was undated, but likely taken by the British missionary George Laws during the 1880s, when Papua was known as British New Guinea and part of the empire. Giyua proved to be politically motivated, collaborating with the missionaries and explorers that visited Port Moresby and Manu Manu during the late 19th century. Her prominence as an intermediary associated with the mission site is evidenced in the fact that she was repeatedly photographed. Her image sits amongst the New South Wales State Library's special collection, where George's photographs of Indigenous people, Pacific places, and cultural artifacts are preserved. These photographs offer us a perspective of what it was like for missionaries in the tropical and foreign region of the Pacific. They were created for viewing by external European audiences. But our understanding of Giyua's experiences have been hindered by these stories and the dominance of histories produced by male Western missionaries. Analysing Giyua's photograph illuminates her agency as an Indigenous woman and her position as an intermediary across two distinctive cultures. In 1883, the government of Queensland annexed Papua on behalf of the British Empire. Australian colonists were greatly interested in their northern Papuan neighbours. The interest, it was not social, nor was it scientific curiosity, but it was financial. The landscape of Papua was identified by multiple survey groups from the Australian colonies as a possible site for mining exports. Pushing Britain for their support to settle the island, the Queensland colony's premier, Thomas McIlarath, arranged Papua's annexation. This political land grab was met by representatives from the British Colonial Office with contention. Discussions to secure Papua focused on who would be responsible for Papua, financially and in matters of governance. These negotiations resulted in the formation of British New Guinea the following year. The matter appeared to be settled entirely to Australia's satisfaction in 1906. When control of British New Guinea was transferred to the newly independent Commonwealth of Australia. After World War I, in 1914, the League of Nations granted Australia a mandate to administrate the northern part of the island, German New Guinea. When post-war rhetoric concerning modernisation and development became undeniable in the 1960s, this continuing colonial administration by Australia was fiercely contested by Papuans. In 1975, the people of Papua and New Guinea gained their independence. In 1873, a decade before Britain's annexation of Papua, Giyua experienced the benefits of short-term visits to her village by non-Papuan traders and explorers. People such as Captain John Moresby and the Balliscus crew distributed highly valued trade items such as rice, tobacco, and beads, and they did this for exchange of fresh water, fruit, and vegetables, and the occasional curo, which could take the form of a carved shell or a woven item. That same year, Giwa also encountered representatives from the London Missionary Society. The LMS executive, who were situated in London, decided that Papua would be the next Pacific island to be brought the gospel by missionaries. The site identified for the first Papua mission was the village of Manu Manu at Redscar Bay. The LMS had a set settlement process, one that had been refined since the first evangelical Christians associated with the LMS arrived in the Pacific region in 1796. To ensure attempts at evangelical settlements were successful, first, Indigenous teachers would arrive at a chosen location on the coast, and then, after they had settled themselves, the white British missionaries would arrive to establish a more permanent LMS site. Ultimately, British missionaries wanted the establishment of an Indigenous-built church. They wanted to identify local leaders to be educated as teachers, and the creation of written local languages, which would be used to produce a vernacular Bible and Gospels. So it was at the village of Manu Manu that British Christian missionaries Archibald W. Murray and William Wyatt Gill landed a dozen Polynesians, six Indigenous pastors and their wives, on the shoreline. Murray directed these Polynesian men and women to establish positive relations with members of the Manu Manu community and, if possible, build a church with villagers before the arrival of a European missionary. White missionaries believed that the Polynesian teachers would learn the local language and form productive, reciprocal, social relationships far quicker than their European counterparts ever could. The use of the term Polynesian, though, indicates issues with this process and the importance of local intermediaries to a successful settlement. This term erases uniqueness of Pacific culture, languages, and communities. However, for the missionaries, this broad term identified people that had common enough traits and linguistic styles to communicate with one another in a relatively successful manner. Giwa knew the villagers of Manu Manu well from her previous journeys to trade for food. Intrigued by the news of the arrival of the Polynesians, she travelled there from her home at Hanuabata. She likely walked the 76 kilometres along the coastline, accompanied only by her 16-month-old son. Giwa's interactions with the Polynesian teachers started a long-term reciprocal relationship. In his book, Pioneering in New Guinea, which was published in 1887, missionary James Chalmers described Giwa as a smart and kindly woman. She gathered firewood and fetched water for the mission group. She rebuked and she informed the teachers. Chalmers recounted Giwa telling the missionary group that they were in the wrong place. Come to Hanuabata, the largest of all the villages on this part of the coast. It is my village and the centre of this tribe. We are one. Come and see. This command came at a time when the resolve of the Polynesian teachers was severely tested. After months of persistent illness and numerous deaths, the LMS representatives at Manu Manus relocated to the Port Moresby region near Hanuabata. Then Giwa too returned to her village. When the John Williams missionary ship pulled into the harbour near Hanuabata the next year, in November 1874, Giwa saw it as an opportunity to pursue another profitable encounter. Sitting on the deck was George Laws, a middle-aged, white, English-born, experienced missionary with the LMS. He reflected in a letter to the British Foreign Secretary, Dr. Joseph Mullins, at this time, that he and his dear wife, Fan, felt very strongly God had called us to do his work. Previously stationed at Rarotonga, an island in Polynesia from 1861 to 1873, George had taught Indigenous women and men the gospel, Western industry, and agricultural skills. George, his wife Fan, and their two sons, Charlie and Percy, were the first permanent white settlers near the villages of Hanoabada and Elivana. Their priority was securing a domestic space and making connections with Papuans. Only then would they set about delivering the gospel. And this process they started with Gayua. George was devoted to documenting the progress of the LMS and his interactions with the indigenous intermediaries like Gayua. He updated the LMS Foreign Office with lengthy letters, travel journals, and photographs. George's photograph albums convey his interest in Papua's people, the landscape, cultures, and industry around Port Moresby. During this period of settlement, George produced a series of photographic portraits of the indigenous Motuan and Koyari people associated with the LMS in Papua. Despite written evidence, there is no indication in these photographs that Giyua associated daily with the Laws family in their home. These colonial mission photographs cannot be separated from the imperial framework in which they were created. For historian Jay Lydon, the advent of photography in 1839 offered white settlers like George with the means to share their experiences and encounters with the so-called primitive locals, with people in other colonies and in their home country. George's documents certainly centralise his experience as a missionary. Reading this photograph differently to centre on Giyua's experiences exposes her interests and domestic power. Giyua's links to European cultures are shown in the photograph by her long-sleeved, high-necked gown. The loose bust and the sleeves are adaptations, likely in response to the humidity of the southeastern coast. The clothing deviates the representation from being the stereotypical image of a Papuan woman, a woman that is partially clothed with her breasts bared. The photograph shows Giyua's own Papuan culture. Around her neck are five tight loops and another extended loop to the middle of her chest. This looks to be a shell necklace, a highly visible and portable item of wealth. Her ears carry another important clue as to her status. The scarring and the drop of numerous piercings are there. Decorated with carved tortoiseshell pieces, these piercings signified to other Papuan lohia, or leaders, Giyua's important connections to trade and social networks. George likely staged the photograph in a makeshift studio at the mission house. His image of an isolated woman away from her community serves to suppress Giyua's power. However, her role as a big woman is indicated by her great photographic presence. Historians and anthropologists have debated how helpfully the notion of big men or big women really is. The term could refer to an older person, someone who is respected due to kin relationships, military ability, political and economic connections, or simply somebody who is physically large. But in any case, Giyua lived in a community where both men and women could negotiate for leadership positions. Pacific historians Helen Gardner and Jude Phillips highlight how these images reveal relationships between the missionaries and their intermediaries, particularly the big men. George resisted the popular colonial photography trend of making Giyua anonymous. His copious record keeping indicated her name. Indeed, her relationship with George was not remote and impersonal, but he recognized her maternal authority. Hence why the familiar name of Granny was written across the bottom of the photograph. It took time for these photographs to reach a wider audience. The LMS did not circulate any Papua images through their periodicals, such as the Chronicle, until after 1900. Instead, George's photographs were sent directly to the LMS Executive Board, where they were constructed into two albums, likely done by an office clerk. George's albums reflected the 19th century mission agenda. His images of indigenous villages and sacred platforms and traditional trading vessels are slowly replaced as his album progresses, and it shows us westernization with a native church, a general store, the first Christian wedding party, and the homes of the missionaries themselves. It is easier to identify George's defiance of colonial mission photography than it is to read how Giyua, as an Indigenous intermediary, considered her involvement with George's photography. Was she told how to pose? Did she know that these photographs would be shared amongst the LMS network? Did she believe that the production of such an image was another means of increasing her trade connections or her reputation? These documents have been copied and now exist in various archives and libraries, especially within the Pacific region. Microfilmed and digitized copies provide researchers with widespread access and the potential for more narratives to be proposed about Giyua's role in Port Moresby LMS settlement. Giyua's presence in the digital archives has dual and opposing powers. As Leiden suggests, colonial photographs have more uses today than ever was intended by their initial creator. They can move beyond their colonial purpose to provide a pathway to understand Indigenous intellectual property rights and support the culturally appropriate transmission of historical knowledge for community today. As Leiden reflects, knowing the political power of women like Giyua enables us to see the people less as objects of pity or sympathy, but as human beings with rights. Today, Papua New Guinea is an incredibly diverse place. There's approximately 5 million people speaking 700 different languages. And this photograph of Giyua shows us that early settlers, such as the Laws, required the knowledge and the social connections of a Motua woman such as Giyua to succeed in their evangelical mission.
Empire Lines is produced by Yelena Sofronievich. For more episodes, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.